And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. It's that time of year, and there's no denying it. It's Oscar time, and today we are offering our Oscars omnibus. We'll talk about all 9 Best Picture nominees, what we like, what we don't like, what we expect to see at the ceremony, and perhaps you will finally get to see how Steven really felt about the Hugh Jackman performance he's been quoting for months. All that plus we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and theater and pop culture of various sorts for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm happy to see everybody at Oscar time.
Yeah.
And all 4 of us. Uh-huh. Have seen all 9 Best Picture nominees.
Hey, wait, you broke my news.
Is that accurate?
You stepped on my lead. Yes, I finally have seen all the Oscar nominees before the Oscars.
Trey did the homework.
Right.
I feel like those French people in Les Mis.
Exactly.
I'm going to wave my flags and walk.
Which one's the one's getting dragged through the sewer?
Yeah. Yeah, do you hear the people saying it's Trey saw all the movies?
Nice. Mm. Good job,
excellent.
Buddy.
And you
right
saw
down to the wire.
And you saw
thanks
the movies,
for doing
too?
The bare minimum.
And you saw all the movies, too, Glenn. Is that correct?
I did, as a matter of fact.
Is this your first year seeing all of them in a while?
Well, since they've gone up to do, you know, the gigillion, whatever they do. Yeah, but before, when it was just the 5, it was pretty simple, but then it became hard. But now I did it.
Right, and now it's 9. So I do want to get out of the way right away. What happened when Stephen watched Les Mis? I will start with that.
It's amazing how many, because I tweeted, like, I'm about to watch Les Miserables, hashtag what have I done,
hashtag sweet Jesus, what have I done. Right, yes, right.
And I got a ton of, like, what is that? He's gonna hate it. I mean, it's not for me. Mm-hmm. Like, the movie was not made for me. It doesn't mean I thought it sucked. Mm-hmm. There were elements of it that I just could not sign on to at all. But there were points, sort of like Glenn, when Glenn had seen it last week and was talking about how he loved that one, was it One More Day?
One day more.
A, I didn't love it. I said it. I believe you said
I loved it.
That's not what I said.
Wow.
Not even remotely.
I was going to say that was a little bit Charles Nelson.
Let the record show.
I think that was a hate crime.
I was going to mention it, but thank you for mentioning it. Linda.
I actually tried to butch that up a little bit, just as it was coming out of my mouth.
Let's exit this right now.
I really enjoyed One Day More. I cannot lie, I'm affected by the song I Dreamed a Dream.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by, when hope was high and life worth living. I dreamed that love would never die. I dreamed that God would be forgiven.
Mm-hmm. I'm affected by it. I think the melody is...
It's a terrific song.
It's staggeringly beautiful. I thought Anne Hathaway was terrific. A lot of my indictments of the movie are, frankly, indictments of the work from which it is adapted. And so it's hard to be like, why is this parole... Why is he like the parole officer's white whale? This is stupid. You know, there's a certain amount of that. And there's also an element of once the plot shifts over to Cosette, it becomes like Cosette and her new love affair with this member of One Direction. And it's, to me, much less effective. Even though there are still these undercurrents of life and death, it's still a life and death story. It becomes this kind of mawkish conventional romance where these people fall in love at first sight. And, you know, like, and, you know, and there's a lot of like dying of sad. And, you know, and dying of...
She dies of tuberculosis. She didn't die of sad.
And dying of happy. There's a whole lot
she
of...
She died of selling her teeth.
There's a lot of bogus dying in this movie.
Wow. This is the
bogus
least,
dying.
This is the least charitable read of the story of Les Mis I have ever
heard.
Well,
what did you think of it, Trey?
I have to say, now that I have seen all 9 of them, that if you had told me going in that Les Mis would have been the one I... was least attached to at the end of the run, I would have told you were crazy. But that's actually how it shakes out. It sort of holds up least well for me. It's very pretty. As I've said before, it's very pretty. the musical storytelling sort of works for me, sort of doesn't because of the way it's been adapted for the film. But
Well, I had some issues with that. I mean, I haven't seen the play, but everybody who has seen it, including my mother, tells me that that scene with the barricades is so stirring. And it's this grand, it's the chandelier of this.
In the original production, yes.
In the original production. It's this giant thing. And it struck me as interesting that when we go to see the barricade scene, it looks like it's on a set. It looks small. And I kind of figure out why they're doing it, because the final shot of the film is that bigger, and it wouldn't have the payoff if they didn't kind of hem you in and make you feel...
Sure.
But there were so many basic things. Like, I didn't understand that that was only one barricade of many. I mean, like,
yes.
So lots of
yes.
basic narrative storytelling just didn't work on me. This was not my thing.
Oh, I cried. I cried so much.
You did?
I cried a bunch. I cried
when?
And cried and cried.
Name a time.
Wait, hold on. There are points in that movie that are basically pulling out your nose hairs.
Yeah.
It's not surprising.
Steven is really concerned that you're going to think it's unmanly if, let's say, for example, someone might have cried. I cried. Oh, gosh. I cried when Fantine died. I cried. Oh, that ending where he's going off into the thing. And
you're not spoiled.
Into the IKEA.
The whole ending where it's very beautiful and they recite the moral of the story. You know, I don't know. I thought it was, I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried. I sobbed like a baby.
Well, then it was effective in doing what it wanted to do.
Exactly.
Yes.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Les Mis. I do think that for me, it was an interesting experiment that they chose to do a musical that way.
Mm-hmm.
As I've said before, prioritizing immediacy and authenticity over perfection of singing performances.
Wait. You're saying that Russell Crowe's vocal performance was not perfect?
All right. I think he got a bum rap.
Actually, I thought
he was
fine.
That guy got a bum.
I thought it was fine, too.
He was perfectly fine.
I think he's in a band.
Man.
He has 30-odd foot of grunts.
Yes.
We had a long-running joke at the AV Club whenever Russell Crowe's name came up. Like, not really a big fan of him as an actor. Love his work in 30-odd foot of grunts.
Yeah, I thought he was okay. I mean, I thought he was okay. But also, interesting point. I cried all over Les Mis. Did not cry during Amour.
I had the exact... I did not cry all over Les Mis. I cried a couple times during Les Mis.
Oh, my God.
But I did
it's
not cry.
Fine.
I cried at the end of Frankenweenie. There are no illusions here. I cry at the end of everything. I am very, very affected by music, which Amour did not have, which meant that instead of crying...
Except in a couple of very important places.
There is music that is integral to the plot, but
it's
being...
It diegetic?
Yes.
But
it's being played in the movie.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
That's different. There is no music swelling during emotional scenes in Amour.
Right.
And thus, the toxins of that movie stay in you for like 12 hours.
Yes.
Because you can't cry them out.
Cry them out.
This is clearly a very deliberate choice on the part of this filmmaker. It is the most severe and restrained, most disciplined kind of filmmaking, and I loved it.
Yeah. I got to say, I was preparing to hate this film because I hated a film he did called Funny Games.
You're talking about Michael Haneke?
Michael Haneke, right. Which is using the same toolkit of, you know, being very spare and unsparing in shoving your face in thing and making it so you can't look away. Funny Games is about a home invasion, and he's constantly having the cast break character and address the audience and say, why are you watching this? You're horrible people, and... You know,
dear audience,
you
I
just
want
you. You're just sadistic and you're just voyeurs, and it's like it feels like an empty exercise because he's not telling me anything. Oh, cinema is voyeuristic? Go figure. Never figured that out. It's pointless and therefore depressing. Here, getting back to the point you made earlier, Linda, is it's sad but not depressing because this is an existential horror film.
Mm-hmm.
He's
sure.
shoving something in your face that we all have to face and we can't look away from.
Right.
So it feels that like this exercise, we're going, I never want to see this film again, but I'm really glad and really admired the unstinting nature of it. And it does feel sometimes like you're watching an after school special, or like a driver's ed film, like Blood on the Asphalt.
Here blood on the asphalt.
Blood in the tastefully appointed Parisian apartment, because that apartment was awesome.
That apartment is awesome.
That's
I have a
awesome
feeling
apartment.
That neighbor was hanging around so much just because he's like, so you think but months? Is it rent control?
Rent control?
Yeah. Oh my God.
And you can just imagine the landlord being like, so it's steam heat. Is sometimes we get an infestation of the pigeon of death. But you just have to shoo them out the window. Just shoo, shoo, shoo. And everything is fine again.
I had no idea there was so much Amour material to be had.
Who knew Glenn had an Amour chunk?
The portentous pigeon of death.
Yeah,
wow.
Comes back.
Yeah.
The sound of his wings.
Yep.
It's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned admiration with regard to Moore, because I thought about admiration and the idea of admiration with regard to Lincoln. It took me a while to figure out what sort of broke my heart a little bit about Lincoln, and specifically about Steven Spielberg. And part of it is, when I think about Steven Spielberg, the way that I grew up with Steven Spielberg, the entire point of Steven Spielberg was that, you know, the guy made Jaws, mm-hmm. and Raiders, and E.T., and Close Encounters. And in a lot of ways, what he did, in my opinion, at that time in American film, is he made movies that people loved so much that they had to admit they admired them, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because they loved them so much.
Right.
Now he makes movies that you admire so much that you're supposed to love them.
that's interesting.
And it's like sometime around, you know, Amistad and Saving Private Ryan and all that stuff.
Sort of post-Schindler's.
Schindler's, work. Munich, yeah. and all that stuff. He kind of made this turn, which in a way is, and I apologize for saying this, is the Oprah turn,
yeah.
which is the, now I'm incredibly powerful, mm-hmm. and I want to use my power for something that's important. Now,
right.
this doesn't mean that I am comparing these two people to each other directly.
I'm going to devote myself to good works.
But it's now
but
I want...
very safe works.
But that can ultimately make you less interesting, as I think it did with Oprah. Mm-hmm. It makes you a less interesting, less lively, less human-feeling person. And I think with him, when I look at Lincoln, like, look, it's Tony Kushner. It's well-written. The Daniel Day-Lewis performance will and should win Best Actor. It's a wonderful performance. I like a lot of the writing. I like a lot of the acting. I think the acting from Sally Field and Tommy Lee Jones is
little,
I could take or leave.
A little over the top.
I think those are both, to me, those both feel a bit like obligatory nominations.
Yeah. Chewy, yeah.
I would much, and we'll get back to this, but I would much rather have seen them nominate the guy who played Adult Pi in Life of Pi.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I believe his name is Mr. Pi.
But for me, Lincoln is largely a film to be admired. And the exact thing I loved about Spielberg was those were films to be loved.
Hmm. I kind of felt that we had two vastly different styles at loggerheads, and that's why this film left me very unsatisfied and just feeling phony. You have Tony Kushner, whose work is always, even when he's not, leave Angels in America aside.
Right.
Carolina Change, there is a lyrical elegance to his dialogue, to his scene setting. There's a light touch that it kind of elevates, it inflates your chest. And in this film, Spielberg's direction was so heavy and pushy mm-hmm. and ham-handed and right on the nose.
It's like elegiac from the first frame. Right.
Exactly. But see, so many of these scenes, I thought, would work if I'd seen them on stage. Now, maybe that's just a cheap mm-hmm. thing to say because Kushner's a playwright. But, mm-hmm. I mean, that first moment, which has been discussed a lot with the two black soldiers talking to Lincoln, yeah. while he, by the way, is sitting exactly in the pose,
that's
that he's sitting
the monument.
In the Lincoln Memorial,
looking down at them while yeah. they look up at him.
What's your name, soldier?
Private Harold Green, sir.
I'm Corporal Ira Clark, sir.
How long have you been a soldier?
2 years, sir.
2nd Kansas Colored Infantry, they fought bravely at Jenkins Ferry.
That's right, sir.
It's a little on the nose.
And the scene where the black soldier walks away into the night reciting the Gettysburg Address.
Yeah.
That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, for the people.
A scene, a moment that would have killed in the theater,
right.
but something about
yeah.
the fact that you can't get away from this swelling music, pushing you, making you feel, this is how I want to make you feel in this scene, this is how I want to make you feel in this scene.
You're
and, you know, as much as I admired the machination part, it just felt like West Wing with bad teeth.
Yeah.
oh.
Yeah. I think, Stephen, you saw Lincoln. What did you think of Lincoln?
You know, I saw Lincoln, actually, as I recall, in fairly close proximity to Amour. And one of my reactions to Amour was if Steven Spielberg had directed it, the music would have destroyed it.
yeah.
I didn't have quite as powerful a negative reaction to the music in Lincoln. I just found Lincoln, I liked it better than War Horse. sorry.
Not a high bar.
Well, right.
Speaking of what Spielberg's doing now, though.
Right. But it has a little bit of the same clunk to it.
Yeah.
It's very well made. It's very well acted.
Yeah.
There were points at which I found myself sort of reflexively admiring some of the more over-the-top performances like Sally Fields, but it did not really stick with me in any serious way. It was a very history booksy, you know, it was making some points you don't always hear in history books about some of the political machinations. That was interesting, but to me, it would be very disappointing to me if this won Best Picture, because it was the safest, big, fat meatball up the middle.
Well, and that's what I mean about Spielberg, is he used to be the opposite of that. Right. He was the guy who made great movies that didn't feel like what a great movie was supposed to feel like. And now he makes the greatest great movies.
Can I be the annoying white liberal guilt guy at the party who whines about the fact that they make this film and they don't even have Frederick Douglass anywhere in this film?
Yeah. No,
this is a complaint that has been much discussed.
I know it has, but I mean, it just felt like this. Why are we watching all these white people?
I would commend to you the piece that Jean Demby wrote for the blog about Lincoln and Django, in which she made the same point, which is Lincoln does ultimately reduce slavery to a problem of a lot of white people and something that white people are arguing about in the abstract, and where it has black characters, specifically the two women.
Their job
who
is to
are
gaze
involved,
admiringly.
The two women who are involved, that reveal of S. Apatha Murkison at the end, where you learn that the Tommy Lee Jones character lives with this black woman. To me, I felt like, are you kidding me that we didn't see any of her the rest of the movie? You don't want to tell that story at all. You would rather include everything about the bribes and the James, as I've said before, James Spader playing the guy who locked up the Brady Bunch in the ghost town.
The prospector.
The crazy, sort of doing his crazy prospector routine. To me, that they left that character and also the character played by Gloria Rubin, who is so wonderful and gets so little to do in big movies, I was very frustrated. And Gene wrote about that, too, on the blog.
To be scrupulously fair to the filmmakers, they did base it on a history book. It feels like a history because it is based on a nonfiction history.
Absolutely.
You're talking about the Team of Rivals book.
Team of Rivals book. By Doris Kearns Goodwin. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they took some liberties. Should they have taken some more? Probably.
Yeah. I mean, they are excerpting a very small piece of that book. I know, because I tried to read that book. Specifically, I tried to listen to that on audiobook.
Oh, my.
And let me tell you right now, the problem with audiobooks, you can't skim. That makes it not the way to read that book.
Yep.
But at any rate, I like Lincoln, but again, I feel pressured to admire it more than love it. And Trey, I think you were going to say something about the music in Lincoln.
Yeah. I mean, I think the music in Lincoln, as Glenn said, is kind of manipulative. That's the one thing I felt that's a negative feeling at all about Beasts of the Southern Wild. Score is evocative. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of lovely scenes where there's some fireworks and celebratory music. But I did feel steered around just a tiny bit in those moments. And I liked it so much better when they were trusting that young woman. And her name is, I can actually do this, Kwavenjene Wallace.
Kwavenjene Wallace.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And young woman, I believe she's 9.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I liked Beasts of the Southern Wild. The way that Stephen talked about Lincoln kind of not sticking with him, mm-hmm. I've had that experience a little bit with Beasts. I felt like I really enjoyed watching it. I really loved watching her. I think she has a wonderful face and a wonderful expressive quality. They're talking to her apparently to be in the Will Smith Annie, which I think is really cool,
awesome,
which I would love. But the film didn't stick with me that much. And I think it's one of the reasons why I'm not as bothered by certain things about it as some people were. Because some people were very bothered, felt it was that it romanticized poverty.
Hello. Hi.
Yeah.
I'm Glenn. Nice to meet you.
I think the reason that didn't bother me was that I didn't take the movie as being that big. You know what I mean? I didn't take the movie as being a statement. I saw the movie as being a little story.
Right. I struggled with this movie. I wanted to like it a lot more than I ended up liking it. And I read a lot of fiction which takes this same tack. And maybe that's why it kind of falls into this genre that I'm up to here with, where poverty is seen as ennobling and touched by magic, and the people who suffer under its yoke are somehow nobler and closer to nature or
closer
or,
to some understanding of the universe.
Some idealized thing. It strikes me as a modern update of the noble savage thing, and it's really condescending, and it feels gross to me.
Really? I did not have that reaction to this movie at all. I did not feel like it was romanticizing poverty. I thought it made poverty look awful.
Right.
And I think that part of the subtext of this movie is that it's very hard to believe as you're watching it that this is occurring in America.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so you are seeing a pocket of America that you traditionally don't see, and it looks like in some ways, you know, as much as there is community bonding and as much as there is this incredible survival instinct at work, it looks miserable and it looks inescapable. And sometimes it's really easy to make it seem less like that.
Right. I'm not talking about it romanticizing the experience of poverty and making it look gauzy and magical, although there is, I think, some of that.
There is some of that.
What I'm talking about here is its effect on characterization, where a lot of work that would otherwise need to be done by the filmmakers is not done because they feel like they can kind of say we're in this community. And especially when it comes to the fabulist elements, not the fabulous elements, but the fabulist elements.
Yeah, which those did not work for me.
Really felt like they were wallpapering over some big, flat characterizations and just some story logic that didn't work for me. Like, when, you can't call it magical realism because technically it's not Latin America, but let's call it magical realism.
I was just going to say, to me, it's magical realism.
It grows out of, it's kind of like in a musical, when the emotions break through the reality and there's this surge of fantasy elements. And it is echoing, underscoring, underlining emotions that are there. It's a way of expounding upon that. And these felt like they were coming at the thing in ways that I just didn't understand. This could just be me.
Oh, it's interesting, because I've read a conversation with the filmmakers who have said things that make me think that's exactly what they intended. That these giant, horrifying beasts who you see occasionally throughout the movie.
And who did not work for me at all.
Yeah. They're meant to be manifestations in her mind of how she feels about herself and her understanding that she and her kind are a vanishing species.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't get it. Well, yeah. This whole thing can be called Glenn didn't get it.
No. I understand.
Well, here's another point. Is Trey, why don't you hit us with the actress's name again?
Quvenzhané Wallace.
Can she be legitimately the best actress of the year?
Well,
acting at age 6.
I was very interested in this because it got me thinking about people like Hailee Steinfeld, who was nominated in supporting category
for... She was like 12 or 13.
For True Grit. Haley Joel Osment, who was nominated in a supporting category for The Sixth Sense. Both of those are lead performances, unquestionably.
Absolutely.
I'm interested in the fact that for whatever reason... In this case, they went with a lead performance nomination
I think it's a less crowded field. I think it's a matter of where are we more likely to get nominated.
But to me, it is interesting to see them say, yes, you know, this six-year-old.
She was five when she auditioned, six when she acted, and is nine now.
Mm-hmm. And so I do think it's interesting that this performance, which it is really difficult because you don't want to take anything away from her performance. And she has a wonderful presence. I think every acting performance is a combination of presence and skill, right?
Sure.
And I do think with a six-year-old, that has to be tipped massively toward presence.
Presence
it doesn't mean it's not acting.
Right.
Because if you look at actresses like Julia Roberts or somebody like that, so much of that is presence. Tom Hanks, a lot of that is presence. It's your being. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean it's not acting, and it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with what she's doing. Do I think a six-year-old is acting with great skill in the same way that, for example, Emmanuel Riva is in Amour?
Seriously.
No, I don't. So if you want it to be a skill award, then I probably would not pick her, just because I think so much of it is her being and her instinct, her ability to instinctively connect with this story, which is wonderful to see and which bodes enormously well for her character. And there was some great acting by kids this year. It's not nominated for Best Picture, but to me the best thing in The Impossible, the tsunami movie, is the performance by a kid whose name I unfortunately am now going to not remember because I didn't bring it with me because it's not nominated. But the kid who plays sort of the son is, to me, the best part of that movie. And so it is a very interesting question at what age you can start to consider it real acting. But
yeah, I mean, it's a very effective performance, but you wonder how much of that is the general makeup of this kid.
Well, exactly.
How much of this is the way the kid kind of is?
I don't think you would find that she had to dig super deep to have kind of that wonderful quality of excitement and curiosity. I suspect the curiosity in that kid's eyes is there all the time. Yeah. That would be my guess.
But also the poise in the backbone.
I think
that's a natural for that kid.
I agree. You know, one that we did talk about when it came out is Argo.
What happened?
Six of the hostages went out a back exit.
Where are they? The Canadian ambassador's house.
We've got Revolutionary Guards going door to door. These people die. They die badly.
White House?
Who wants the six of them out?
I got an idea.
They're a Canadian film crew for a science fiction movie.
I fly into Tehran. We all fly out together as a film crew.
We spent a good amount of time on Argo when it came out. And I will just say, in my own rah-rah corner, before the nominations came out, I had made the comment that, to me, I at that point thought Lincoln was the frontrunner for Best Picture, but said, if it's not Lincoln, my guess is Argo. And at that time, Argo was not a frontrunner for Best Picture.
Right.
But my thinking was, a lot of the other ones are polarizing, right? Django, Zero Dark Thirty, Silver Linings over the mental illness stuff. So I'm not that surprised that it emerged. It's got a lot of humor in it. I think Ben Affleck is a very well-liked guy right now. So it has a lot going for it. It has some very well-liked character actors in it.
Well, Alan Arkin.
Alan Arkin, John Goodman.
Right.
Talk about goodwill.
Kyle Chandler, who now is apparently playing just government bureaucrats since he stopped playing Coach Taylor.
Well, I think that the one thing that would seem to be a drag on its chances of being Best Picture is that it's not nominated for Best Director, which to me was the one that really bugged me.
Right.
That Ben Zeitlin, the director of Beasts of the Southern Wild, a movie I like, I did not feel like that was a massively astonishing feat of directing. And I thought Argo was an astonishing feat of directing. I thought it was a great directorial performance.
Yeah. Well, and I've said this before, but to me, the hardest thing about Argo is maintaining the balance between seriousness and humor, between a very scary situation and the humor that they put into it. And they've been running a feature on Vulture where screenwriters talk about the toughest scenes to write. Mm. And the screenwriter who talked about Argo talked about that balance between, you know, you don't want it to come off like a comedy.
Right.
It can't come off like a comedy, and yet the comedy has to work.
Yeah.
So
I hadn't seen Argo when you guys were talking about it before, but as I saw it, I just kept thinking, yep, you guys, you know, got it right. It's a solid film. It's full of suspense. I thought it was really well done. Did I think it was the best picture of the year? I don't know about that. But, I mean, it was solid. The narrative I'm picking up on now, though, is that this film is so besotted with Hollywood that its chances for winning Best Picture are increasing as...
Because it's a mash note to Hollywood.
Because it's a mash note to Hollywood. And if anything the Oscars are about, it's about how much filmmakers love themselves.
And let me just say this. I saw this film in Toronto at the film festival, right? And a film festival like Toronto is heavily filled with industry people. The industry jokes in this movie were received like money was dropping from the ceiling of the theater. There's a joke in there about you ought to, you know, wait till you see the WGA or something like that.
Yeah.
These jokes were like catnip to these people. So if Hollywood is anything like a film festival audience, and it is, then I think they're going to be even happier about those jokes. Because it's not just a love letter to Hollywood. It's also a love letter and also we're making fun of it, right?
Yeah, sure.
So they get to feel good but also feel like, oh boy, ain't that the truth.
But they're also the heroes. They're actually the heroes.
Yeah. I do love Argo. And I think it will probably win, but who knows?
I mean, I think it was probably my favorite movie-going experience. The other one that, well, which we'll talk about is Django.
Know what a bounty hunter is?
You kill people, and they give you a reward.
Better they are, bigger the reward.
I need your help. I'm looking for the Brittle brothers. However, I don't know what they look like, but you do. Don't you?
They caught my wife, and they sold her, but I don't know who to.
That means we visit every plantation until we find them.
Once a final Brittle brother lies dead in the dust, I agree to give you your freedom. And I'll take you to rescue your wife.
Where are we going?
If you want to talk about the ones I loved,
yeah,
I think Django is the one I loved the most.
Yeah, I was surprised to discover that for myself. I am by no means a Tarantino junkie, but I really enjoyed that movie. It was fun to sit through.
Yeah.
Yeah, the question that it poses, of course, is the same question that that Inglourious Bastard posed, which is, can you take this grievous open wound on the nation's soul and turn it into a cathartic, feel-good, revenge
fantasy? How good does it really feel?
Revenge fantasy.
Does it entirely feel good?
Well, I mean, that's the thing.
There are some grisly, horrific things in that movie.
And he's playing fast and loose with the tone. The violence early on is hard to look at, and the violence at the end is sort of peck and paw, like,
This is kind of what I like about it, though. I think he's playing in a really smart way with all of these ideas, with ideas about bloody violence and with ideas about, you know,
he's not going for realism in his violence.
I just enjoyed it so much.
Scenes where the violence is more realistic.
Yeah, that's what
I'm saying. It's when the slave is being chased by the dogs.
Sure,
and
that's
horrific. It's horrible, and it's absolutely a sort of judgmental depiction of that society.
Yeah. And then pulling out the rug at the end and saying, just kidding, essentially. You know, that's a legitimate thing that's, I think, is a little weird about it. There was a really interesting essay on the literary magazine Jacobin, which basically said, you know, there's a rich history and literature of slave revolt that Tarantino could have availed himself of, where it's the blacks having agency themselves to rise up, and he's not interested in that. He's interested in the one man, you know, coming back, and that's the film he'll make. That's the film he's always going to make. And so, you know, that essay was kind of saying, why didn't he do that? I think it's very obvious why he didn't do that, because he's just not that filmmaker.
That's just not what interests him.
You know the whole, like, in Gladiator, the whole are you not entertained thing? I was entertained.
Yeah. Right. What I missed from this, in Inglourious Bastard, there were two scenes of unbearable suspense. Inglourious Bastards had that scene in the bar where the guy's ordering the drinks, and also the scene in the farmhouse, obviously, with Christoph Waltz. Nothing like that here. I didn't feel anything like that sort of unbearable set piece.
I think the dinner a little
bit. I was going to say a little bit at the dinner table.
Some of that. The dinner table has some of that. I think they keep going back for that when he keeps putting his hand toward the gun and then taking it away and then putting it back and taking it
away. They spend a good 20-30 minutes sort of ratcheting. When is this going to explode?
You can kind of
this
tell.
Room going to blow up? Yeah.
And it has a certain element of this room is going to explode. It's going to happen sooner or later. Is it now? Is it now? Is it now? It's not now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of some of the more questionable decisions that are made in that movie, I think there's a stretch of that movie. As much as I was completely engrossed by it for the entire this is the longest movie that is nominated for Best Picture. Yeah. This thing is 2 hours and 45 minutes long.
I was shocked it didn't feel long.
It does not feel long, but there are a few scenes that drag a bit. I also, as much as I absolutely love, and Linda, you and I have talked about this, the amount of stunt casting in this movie and the amount of commentary through the casting of Don Johnson, Tom Wopat, Lee Horsley, and people like that, I really deeply wish he had not cast himself.
Yeah.
With the accent.
I mean, it's the only time in the movie when I actually felt pulled out of the movie.
Yeah.
I do think it's just a fact of life that when Christoph Waltz is not on screen, this film doesn't have the energy that it has with him. He is great.
He is so great in this movie.
Yeah.
Is he nominated for Best Actor or Supporting Actor?
He is nominated for Actor in a Supporting Role.
Okay.
And I will say, there is a moment, and it is the last scene in the film that Jamie Foxx and Christoph Waltz share the screen, right? There is a gesture that Jamie Foxx makes that was so unexpected to me that I choked up instantly. And I was so surprised, because it wasn't where I was in that movie, I thought.
Yeah.
But he makes this gesture, and I just, all of a sudden, I felt myself just tear up. And I was just, I love that movie.
Funniest Ku Klux Klan scene since Blazing Saddles.
Oh, my God.
It's a very Blazing Saddles.
It's a very funny scene.
And that scene could have been a disaster. Yep. If you're not into that movie by that point, that sudden change of tone is very jarring. But you realize in that scene that you were going wherever that movie's
going. And that's another great piece of casting, in the sense that you put Jonah Hill in that scene. Yes. So people realize now we are in the world of kind of cornball movie comedy. I love what he does with casting in this movie. I don't always like Tarantino, but holy cow, I love that movie. Another one that has been kind of considered to be in play for Best Picture was Silver Linings Playbook.
I think it's very much in play.
Yeah. What did you think of it?
Well, first of all, I think it's very much in play in part because of the Weinstein effect, which I find grody.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that is not a commentary on the movie.
Right.
I think there's an enormous amount of controversy surrounding how this movie portrays mental illness in general and bipolar disorder specifically. If you can try to separate yourself from that, and everybody has different experiences with people who deal with these disorders, there is some wonderful acting in this movie. I think Bradley Cooper is great in it. I think Jennifer Lawrence feels to me a little more like a supporting role.
Yeah.
But I found myself swept up in this movie. I found myself sort of, even though it's following some fairly conventional rhythms, it's actually very similar to The Fighter in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. It is. But which is also David O. Russell. Same.
It's
director.
Also David O. Russell. I mean, The Fighter has that Melissa Leo performance mm-hmm. that won an Oscar that mm-hmm. I was not a fan
yeah,
of.
Right. Yeah.
This is a
gotcha.
Little less. I mean, there's certainly histrionics.
There's nothing as big as that.
Right. There are certainly histrionics in this movie, but it is not as cartoonish yeah. to me.
Right.
I did not think it was the best movie of the year. Yeah. I think it is over awarded. I think in large part because of the Weinsteins, mm-hmm. but I enjoyed it.
I will say I was with it right up until they had to lip sync for their life. And then I was like, oh, okay, that's how we're going to resolve all
yeah.
of this?
Yeah. You know,
that said, I've heard people talk on both sides of the coin about De Niro. I was with him the whole way.
I liked him.
And
I liked him in it.
I've heard people say he was just doing De Niro. And I'm
sort
not
of,
sure I
yeah,
feel
but he hasn't
that
been
way.
That good sort in a movie in so long.
He hasn't been that restrained.
Doing it in a good
really
way, I think.
Really restrained.
Yeah.
And I adore Jackie Weaver, so I'm really glad to see her get a second nomination.
Yeah, I thought this was a pleasant little film. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I love David O. Russell. And any chance to see Jennifer Lawrence exhibit anything resembling a sense of humor mm-hmm. is a good thing because mm-hmm. she has to be so noble and long-suffering in mm-hmm. in The Hunger Games. And, of course, Winter's Bone was not a laugh riot. So, you know, anytime she can express some of the humor that she has naturally, if
right.
you've ever seen her interview,
absolutely.
She's a delight.
She's very fun.
And, you know, the ending is problematic. However, this film has an internal logic, which you either buy or you don't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you look
right.
at it from the outside, the whole final bet doesn't make any sense. Yeah, and why are we here now? And, like,
yeah.
but there is this
why is the ex-wife
small,
here?
And actually,
no, seriously.
Right. And if you actually think of that scene in his parents' bedroom where he's railing against, you know, mm-hmm. the lack of a happy ending in Hemingway, mm-hmm. it's like the filmmaker is kind of cluing you in mm-hmm. that the fix is in mm-hmm. a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Stupid book. I just can't believe Nikki's teaching that book to the kids. I mean, it's the whole time. Let me just break it down for you. The whole time you're rooting for this Hemingway guy to survive the war and to be with the woman that he loves, Catherine Barkley.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, Pat.
And he does. He does. He survives the war after getting blown up. He survives it. And he escapes to Switzerland with Catherine. But now Catherine's pregnant. Isn't that wonderful? She's pregnant. And they escape up into the mountains, and they're going to be happy, and they're going to be drinking wine, and they dance. They both like to dance with each other. There's scenes of them dancing, which was boring, but I liked it because they were happy. You think he ends it there? No. He writes another ending. She dies, Dad. I mean, the world's hard enough as it is, guys. It's fucking hard enough as it is. Can't somebody say, hey, let's be positive? Let's have a good ending to the story?
I didn't, frankly, find that the ending tied everything up in as neat a bow as everybody else seems to think it is.
Right.
So, you know.
I think it's shot like it does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
I think if you think about the story, it doesn't.
Absolutely.
And I will say, I had a lot of concerns about the portrayal of mental illness. I do think, in general, suggesting that mental illness is quirky mm-hmm. is just another way of being an oddball.
But there's there are violent outbursts.
But at the same time, there are some moments in this film where I think Bradley Cooper just absolutely nailed what a sort of mentally ill but fairly high-functioning yeah. person can be like, that he's just a little off in a way that I think is extremely skilled. And I think the fact that they do include that scene where he just kind of loses it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, critically, there's a moment in the middle where if you're not paying attention, if you look away from the screen, if you're watching it on home video and you're looking away to do your email, you could miss it because I don't think there's any sound. But there is a scene where he goes back to taking his medication.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Essentially realizes, my plan to just, like, I'm going to be happy now
yeah, visually.
Is not going to work, and goes back to taking his medication. And I saw a review where the reviewer clearly
missed it.
Right. And I thought that is unfair to the film.
It is visually, they make it very clear that that's going on. But you're right. It is never verbally yeah. acknowledged.
Yeah. Another early front runner for Best Picture that I think has faded somewhat due to controversy would be Zero Dark Thirty.
You really believe this story? Osama bin Laden?
Yeah. What part convinced you?
Her confidence.
Well, it was a front runner before it came out and people saw
it. Yeah, yeah. And we are not going to have time to do the entire Zero Dark Thirty debate.
No.
But speaking for myself, I think it's a spy movie.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Speaking for myself, it's a thriller.
Where the tension, a lot of the tension derives from people staring at screens and going, oh my God, you know? I mean, that's part of the deal.
I gotta say, I thought there was a little less there than met the eye in some ways.
I also thought, boy, that's a long movie. That was a movie that felt as long as it was to me. And I liked it fine. But boy, when they say at one point, they refer, oh, there's a town called Abbottabad.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's about time there's a town called Abbottabad, because I'm really wondering when they're getting to the fireworks factory.
At last,
it's
on. Yeah.
And it's sort of like they're at least now in the correct city, because it's going to clearly be quite a while before they resolve this.
And then they've got the long sequence of the raid and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the long sequence of her waiting for them to approve the raid, where you're sort of right there with her writing days on the wall.
The raid itself, I mean, it was incredibly satisfying, incredibly well done, and not this sort of like, it's much more layered than that, much
more
complex, and I thought really unbelievably well handled. I'm not going to say anything more, but the final shot of the film burned away all the goodwill this film had built up for me. I just didn't buy it. I don't think that final shot trusts the audience to pick up on what the actress has been giving you. I don't think it trusts the actress.
I agree.
I think it is a cop-out Hollywood fakey-fake thing in a film that was, up to that point, relatively devoid of that.
I agree.
It is a skilled movie in many ways.
It
is a good movie in many ways. The fact that Kathryn Bigelow was not nominated for Best Director did not bother me a whit.
Yeah.
In part because the damn thing could have been 2 hours long.
Didn't love it.
Could have done all the same things, made all the same decisions, and just been a much more efficient, tighter, efficient piece of storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same co-screenwriter who...
Mark Boal?
Yeah, she and Mark Boal were the team for The Hurt Locker as well. And this has the feel of a team that's, you know, got a couple of big trophies sitting on their shoulders and can do whatever they want.
It does to me, too.
Well, production started before Osama bin Laden was killed. That's the remarkable thing.
That is remarkable.
What would have happened?
Did you just say spoiler alert for he was
killed? Don't believe I do.
I'm just kidding. So the last one that we have on our list is the one that I saw yesterday as we tape this, which is Life of Pi.
So I was sitting in this coffee house, and this old man at the table next to me struck up a conversation.
He said you had an amazing story.
Let's see then, where to begin?
I was born and raised in one of the most beautiful places on earth. It was a time filled with wonder that I'll always remember. But when my family chose to move our zoo halfway around the world, that is when my greatest journey began. The next part of the story you will find hard to believe.
I really liked it, but I'm kind of still thinking about it,
In that Vulture series you were talking about, I read the entry on the screenwriter's choice about which was the hardest scene to write. And oddly enough, or not, they chose the ending, which is, of course, if you've read the book, you'll understand why it was hard to put on screen.
Yeah. Well, I think we can say, first of all, the book's been out for a while. The movie's been out for a while, to the point where I was getting trailers for parental guidance, which, as you may recall, is the Billy Crystal and Bette Midler movie that's long gone already.
Oh, my.
But that's what was tied to this movie, because it was the 3D, and I think it's all a package, and they can't change it. Anyway, I think it's been out long enough that we can say it is a piece of storytelling, right? It's structured as the man telling a story from his youth. And at the end, you get some ambiguity cast on the telling of the story, whether it's all literally true.
You learn some information that changes your understanding of what has gone before.
Because it is a fairly unbelievable story. It's the story of his being, if you don't know it, he's on a ship with his family traveling across the ocean, and the ship sinks, and he is left alone on a boat. In short order, alone on a lifeboat with a tiger. And that is basically what happens.
And hijinks ensue.
And that is the
I think it's important to note that this is called Life of Pi for a reason. It's not called The Shipwreck of Pi, because there's like a good half an hour from the beginning where we get like Pi backstory, and that's fine. I thought this film was as solid an argument for seeing a movie in the theater as I've come across in a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm the guy who likes staying at home, but the 3D here worked for me.
3D's great.
The spectacle of this thing was really appealing, particularly, however, in the tableau, when we were just looking and goggling at and admiring the way a frame was composed and some of the special effects. However, it's kind of an important thing. The tiger looked very CGI to me.
It is CGI.
It did not to me. I usually have, I think, fairly finely tuned CGI'd R.
Oh, man.
And to the point where it really bugs me. I did not feel like the tiger seemed 3D.
About 85% CGI, 15% real tiger.
He moved too quick. I mean, like, something about it. Now, I understand there's a layer of artifice in this tail, and that sort of feeds into that whole thing, and you can kind of, you know, buy into that if you want. But I just really felt like it was not honoring its commitment to the audience on that particular moment.
I did not have that reaction.
You were out on your own.
All.
I did not have that reaction.
Can I ask, Trey Graham, back me up on this. Did you think when this film began that what we were looking at was a blind date?
In what sense?
Well, I mean, like...
Between the writer and...
Because Rafe Spall...
Not with the tiger.
Rafe Spall. That would be weird. Rafe Spall in this scene has this weird energy of nervousness, and you don't know where it's coming from, and there's obviously something going on.
Yes.
And I just didn't understand what that was for.
Yes, now that you mention it, yes, I did think, what is this situation?
And see, I think what I came to understand fairly quickly is, and it's either me being perceptive or me being heteronormative, but what I came to understand pretty quickly was that his nervousness was the result of the fact that it is, in a sense, a blind date, in the sense that he's been sent by the uncle, go talk to my nephew. They don't know each other.
Right.
They are meeting for the first time. So it has some of that nervous energy of a blind date, especially since he knows he's there to hear a specific story, and it's kind of like, let's get down to it. But what I loved about this Irfan Khan performance as the adult Pi, I feel like if you're going to have a movie that is framed entirely through a storyteller, you have to have total confidence in that storyteller, not just veracity-wise, but just that you are in wonderful hands. Mm-hmm. And to me, from the minute he starts talking about his life when he's cooking and he's starting to tell the story, I just felt like I wanted to just listen to him tell the story. Like, I mean, I really enjoyed seeing the story in the movie, but I also would have watched a movie that was just him telling it.
Sure.
Because I was so put at ease by his manner, and I think it gives you a lot of confidence in the movie and confidence that you want to listen to the story.
Yeah, that guy's manner, it's very soothing. It's laconic.
I loved that
Also, while we're talking about these moments, I thought that there were elements of this movie, there were certain frames of this movie, certain shots in this movie that were absolutely spectacular, and I actually felt sad that they had been in the trailer. You know, two in particular. One is the tiger lunging to the end of the boat and swiping out, which of course it partly is a way to, you know, like, haha, 3D. the other is that incredible shot of him kind of hanging in the water as the ship sinks in front of him, and it's shot from behind him. It's incredible visual poetry. Yeah. It is a tremendously beautiful looking film. I think there are years when this would be a clear best picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, seriously.
Yeah.
The moment for the visual moment for me was the night of the bioluminescent barrage.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. I'm going to defend the ending. I've seen people saying, you know, this film breaks its promise, and it that's the point of the film. I mean, leave aside whether or not it's, you know, a pantheistic, omnitheistic, you know, whatever. The point the film is making is are human animals violent and like nature and red in tooth and claw, or is there something else? And that moment, that question is left with the audience. I think this film gives the audience that. It's a discussion. It's fine. I don't think it's necessarily deft or light, or I think it's pretty ham-handed, but, you know, does it make its point? Yes.
I feel like it becomes a very, very rare thing in Hollywood, which is a wonderful meditation on faith, which Hollywood finds very difficult to do, and which is something that is enormously important to many, many, many people who never see it taken seriously at the movies in a meaningful way. And to me, Pi becomes such an allegorical figure himself, no matter what you think happens in the story, how much of it is true, how much of it is not true. No matter what you think about that, he is such an allegorical figure. His name being derived from Pi, the number, the fact that he adopts several different religions, he is standing for something before you even get to this ending. And then you have this ending that to me is this lovely, lovely rumination on faith and religion. And I could talk about this all day, but we unfortunately cannot. But but I did, the more I talk about it, the more I feel like I really did respond to it very well.
Yeah, so, I liked Life of Pi a lot.
Yeah.
Quick round, favorite movie of the year?
You go first.
Me?
Yeah.
I'm going to say Argo.
Okay. Trey?
I'm going to go with Django, although I'm with Glenn in saying I was absolutely taken with Amour and never want to see it again.
Yeah. Glenn.
Looper.
Oh, that's, wow. that's a great pick. That's a wonderful pick. Oh, gosh. I'm going to say Django.
Django's close second for me.
Django, Argo, Life of Pi are the ones of these that I really loved seeing, I think. Amour, again, admired enormously, never want to see it again. Yep. Okay, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Tell us what you liked this year. And that brings us to our final segment, the quickest ever, what is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is very quickly making you happy this week?
All right, I'll try to be quick. This is a little NPR Inside Baseball, but I got to spend today 2 hours talking to and picking the brain of Robert Krulwich of Radiolab and formerly of ABC News.
He has a blog here at NPR.
Has a blog here at NPR called Krulwich Wonders. He's a science expert. He referred in our conversations to an article and a radio story that I went back and sought out because he made it sound, just talking about it, he made it sound so interesting. It's called Does Age Quash Our Spirit of Adventure? And it's all about our brains and when we are most notionally open, to use a phrase we like on this show, when we are most notionally open to new things. It is just an absolutely fascinating story that ties in. It ties into music. It ties into food. It ties into animals. And I will throw a link up on the blog, Does Age Quash Our Spirit of Adventure? Robert Krulwich. It's fascinating and wonderful.
Cool. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
A series of web shorts called Focus Forward Films. They are short 3-minute documentaries about everything from bioluminescent marine creatures, I got to say that twice in one podcast, to the development of a biodegradable graphene supercapacitor that could make batteries as we know them obsolete. Now, it's kind of a reputation polisher for GE, which is the sort of behind it, sponsors the series. But they're real films and real filmmakers. In fact, top-notch filmmakers. You're talking people like Alex Gibney, Morgan Spurlock, Liz Garbus. Pretty serious deals. I think my favorite short so far is by a director called Jessica Yu. And the film is called Meet Mr. Toilet. And it's about a guy, a businessman, whose mission is to improve sanitation conditions for the 40% of the world's population that doesn't have access to a basic toilet. Hmm. And this guy is a little goofy looking, but he's instantly likable, not least because he says things like this.
It's like fire. If you manage properly, the fire can cook your meal. If you don't manage, it burns down your house. If you manage, it becomes a fertilizer.
And the word bleep there, of course, is a word that rhymes with poop.
That you would expect.
Doesn't actually rhyme with poop.
All right, fine.
He says bloop. Yes. It's very confusing.
All right.
No.
Excellent choice.
It's synonymous with poop.
Thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
The Comics Journalism magazine of really high-level comics criticism, interviews, and comics themselves. For much of its history, it was a semi-monthly publication. It is now annual. And it is a giant freaking tome of 600-plus pages that comes looking like basically like a phone book. It's this beautiful, immersive object filled with really great writing about comics. If you're interested at all in the history or the future of comics, it's something to savor. The issue 302, which just came out, includes a 100-plus page interview with Maurice Sendak, his final interview, one of the finest creators, authors, artists of children's books, Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen and many others. And, you know, I've seen excerpts pulled out of this thing. And if you pull out excerpts, he is a bitter, sardonic, you know, guy. He's lost lots of friends. He's lost his lover of many years. And he's, you know, he's about to die in a few months when this interview was taking place. But you can't take these excerpts out. If you take these excerpts out and just read them without any level of irony, you might think that this guy is fundamentally different than who he is. What he is ruefully funny, incredibly smart, and over and over again, the phrase, that's just the way it is. He just keeps saying that over and over again. And if you see that as some kind of like he's giving into despair, he ain't. He's angry. This interview is a testament to the power of humor, black, bitter, sardonic, mordant humor, to rescue yourself from despair. It's a bulwark against despair. And he is so funny and not at all despairing, not at all self-indulgent, not at all self-pitying. It's this old Jewish humor that is giving him life and keeping him alive, and it's just amazing. If you want to know anything about this guy and you want to see the power, sort of a curmudgeon manifesto, this is a great interview.
Okay, so from time to time, my fellow TV critics start talking so much about how much they're enjoying something that even though I have not been watching it, I will suddenly start watching it. And this week it was Scandal, 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 Scandal. Everyone that I know including both Emily Nussbaum and Alan Sepinwall, which if you know anything about those two people, they do not always like the same things. Mm-hmm. This kind of, it's a soapy drama about the president. And we sort of missed the boat last week when we talked about presidents. We didn't talk about this because kind of none of us watch it. But I started watching it. I watched the entire first season, which is like 7 episodes. And then I watched all of this season so far, which is like 15 episodes. I did this all in 2 days. it was joyful and wonderful. It is a bizarre, freaky, increasingly bat poo show. You know, you've got the president and the first lady and all the people moving around in the background. They're all crazy and they're all horrible people. Everyone on the show is a horrible person. There are basically no good guys, except there's like one U.S. attorney who's kind of a good guy.
Josh Molina,
right. An actor I love. But everyone else is amoral and a horrible person, and therefore they can do anything, and they do anything, and people are killing people, and people are sleeping around, and people are doing shocking, awful, amazing things, and the thing is so lively and great, it is just bonkers. But Fitz is the worst. I just want to repeat, Fitz is the president, he is the worst. And in 10 seconds I will also say, I had a conversation this morning on Twitter with Retta from Parks and Recreation and Josh Charles from Sports Night.
Wow.
And now I can die. but I won't. So that's what's making me happy this week. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. Make sure you check out Glenn's piece on Orson Scott Card and Superman this week. It was wonderful. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to you guys for all being here.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.